with Dr. K and Dr. KY's Whitehead yesterday on CBS Sunday Morning. Ted Koppel, who's now a senior correspondent with CBS Sunday Morning, did a whole special talking about Baltimore and what was happening in Baltimore, really focusing on the violence in Baltimore. It was a powerful segment, thinking about where we're going as a city, thinking about the work that we have been trying to do to turn the city around, thinking about the responsibility that everyone has to pour into this city to make it what we all think it could be, what we all think it should be. I mean, Baltimore City has the potential to be a place that meets our wildest expectations, like beyond what we can even imagine, what we can even hope for. Well, yesterday, watching Ted Koppel sit down with one of the founders of Safe Streets, Corey Winfield, having Corey share with Ted his dreams about Baltimore City, we pulled a couple of clips from CBS Sunday Morning, and I wanted to share them with you. The first is just talking about the communities where Safe Streets is located and the work they're doing. So let's hear the first clip from CBS Sunday Morning, Shots Fired.
So young men that you see in our orange shirts, they from here.
In Baltimore, as in so many other cities, gun violence is an epidemic. Corey Winfield and his young Safe Streets recruits were once carriers of the disease. Now, with additional support of the city, they're trying to control the spread.
It was once a part of the problem. They decided to change their life and be a part of the solution.
Former gang members?
Not everybody. Typically in our neighborhood, that's more of drugs and robberies. The cycle of violence, it begins when you're young, and it just goes on perpetual. It never stops. And trauma in our neighborhood, like helicopters, sirens.
Let me just ask you, police chopper?
Yes. Yes. Don't forget, this is a violent area. So just because it's quiet now doesn't mean that it will always stay like that. At any time of day or night, this can erupt.
And it did.
Any time, day or night, this can erupt. And then Ted Koppel says, and it Baltimore City, when we look at the challenges that we are facing, we are dealing with an epidemic of violence. It is not new. I want to be clear that we're not talking about anything new at all. We're talking about the current state of what is happening in this city, and we've been talking about it for years. Baltimore City is in a unique place because we have the resources. Apparently, there is money that we can access that can transform the landscape. I think it's interesting that Ted Koppel said that Baltimore has been dealing with an epidemic of violence and that brothers, I mean, he didn't say brothers, but that's who he was talking about, brothers have been walking around with the disease in them. Interesting choice of words. An epidemic of violence. Police Commissioner Harrison was also on the show, and he was making the argument that we're dealing with, you know, 202, when the time he taped this, 202 homicides, which is the exact same amount we had last year. I am baffled in some ways that during a global pandemic, when everyone was supposed to be shut in the house, we saw the same level of violence that we had seen the previous year and that we're seeing this year. Nothing changed. Corey Winfield went on with Ted Koppel. I have a second clip I want to share. And then I want to open up the phone lines to hear from you at 410-319-8888. Let's go to the second clip from CBS Sunday Morning with Corey Winfield from Safe Streets along with senior correspondent Ted Koppel.
Why is this still happening?
I know it's a saying that hurt people, but where I come from, hurt people kill people. A simple step on your shoe, you don't know the outcome of it.
And there's too many young people, uneducated young people with guns. You're looking at hurt, and you're looking at anger, and you're looking at a race of people, young people, with no vision. I have vision. That's what keep me working. My vision is that one day we're going to have no murders for a whole year. Not just Baltimore. I'm talking about gun violence now. Not just Baltimore, but the United States, my country.
Corey says that he would like to see the entire country move away from using guns as a way of solving or confronting our issues. He said he'd like to see an entire year where there is no gun violence. I was particularly moved by what Corey said, even though I don't think that it is possible. I actually do not believe that America, which is based upon a foundation of violence, of murder, of war, of manifest destiny, of taking what you want, even if you have to take it from someone who needs it. This notion that we are here to tame and rule the land, and that it is the God-given right of white men with manifest destiny to take the country, even though there were people already living here. I mean, there were indigenous people who lived here, one with the soil, with the earth, and manifest destiny said, move them. The Trail of Tears said, kill them. That whatever it took to tame all the land and take it and claim it and control it for our own. How can we get to a point where there's no gun violence in a country that is built upon violence, that's built upon this notion of survival of the fittest? Like, this is where we live. This is who we are. We are a nation that is violent at our core. And I know this is not a popular position. In fact, I think people would rather not talk about it. You can't say that America, and by extension, Americans, are violent. But we are. Corey was saying in this piece, he's like, look, it's not just that hurt people hurt people. It's that even people who've been slighted, people who've been wronged, people who feel like they have nothing going for them, people feel like you're taking something from them. In those instances, there's not a problem with using whatever means necessary to exact some level of revenge or to find comfort that you're doing everything you can to set things in the direction that you will have them to go. We cannot ever get to a point where there is no violence because we are a violent nation. That is who we are. We deal in violence. We have more people who are incarcerated than any other country. We, at one point, I think we're one of only two, maybe three countries that actually give life sentences to children under the age of 16. Like, we are violent by our very nature. Our encounters with the police are rooted in the history of violence. Our encounters with teachers, there's a hostility there that we are fighting with and we're looking at. I'm joined now by Darnell Wharton from Baltimore Ceasefire. Darnell, how are you?
Dr. K, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad you were able to join us because we're just talking through the piece that was on CBS Sunday Morning with Corey from Safe Streets. But I wanted to just get your take on this because I know the work that you and Erica Bridgeford and all of your ambassadors have been doing to turn Baltimore into a city of peace rather than a place of war.
Right.
So Ted Koppel said gun violence is an epidemic. And then he said brothers, I mean, he was talking about young African-American men, carry this disease within them. Can you speak about why that is actually the wrong direction to go in? Because it's not a disease that's carried in us. It's a disease that's forced it upon us.
It's that. See, I didn't see that special, but from you just saying that that's what was said is a horrible way to categorize anything that black men carry within them. Like, we don't, there's not a disease that we carry in us that says that we're prone to, you know, carry guns, or we're just prone to crime. It's in us, like it was born with us or something like that. That's asinine to say that. What it is everybody knows there are factors in our community that contribute to anything that's going on in our community. Once you put somebody in a, let's just start here. The society that we're a part of is already a violent society. America took everything that they have through violence, in war. Everything that they have was gained in some type of violence. America, it's a warring country. So when you take somebody from a place and put them inside a community that is already a war-based type of society, you're putting them into a situation where everything that you're saying to them in order for you to get, in order for you to attain something, some type of violence has to happen. So I'm homeless from my motherland, but now I'm put into a society that says that it's okay to take things through violence. No matter what type of countenance I had in my heart, I know that my society took things through violence, so violence is kind of accepted. So now we get in our disenfranchised communities where you have homelessness, you have hopelessness, you have poverty, you have mental health issues, and all of these things. Our education levels are low. We have corruption in our governments. We have corruption in all of our entities. And then you have families and you have individuals that don't have other choices on how to do things. So when you're struggling and you want to get ahead somehow, just an inch ahead, you think that I gotta do things in order to get that. So I gotta rob this person in order to get that,
right?
Or I gotta kill this person because I don't want to die. It becomes a part of their countenance because of where they already are in the society. And we're not born with that. Like, nobody's born with a disease. Like, you know, when I get older, it's already in me to carry a gun.
Right.
That was a horrible thing to say. When it comes to Baltimore itself, Baltimore is a very, very, very hard city when it comes to trying to get to a certain place of peace. You got to muddle through everything that Baltimore has been through, going all the way back to the Great Fire. You got to muddle through everything that people had to go through and had to live through, especially in these times of social services where they where they take the man out of the house. Because if you want the family to get social services, saying if the family is to survive, we can give them money to do whatever they want to do. They can get an apartment. You just can't have the man in the house. And it goes all the way back to slave times where they took the man out the house and they just put him from house to house and had him breed, but didn't have him have any responsibility. So you're now taking the man out the house who is supposed to be there to help raise the children with the mother. But society is saying we want the man out the house. We only want the mother raising the children. The man got to do it some other way. He has to survive some other way. So now you got all these, you got kids growing up in that. You got a father who's trying to survive. You got a mother who doesn't, who was in the house trying to raise a son and a daughter and trying to do it the best way they can. And all of that breeds trying to get ahead the best way you can.
Right. Well, let me ask you ask you this. Okay, so one of the things that Corey said, Corey from Safe Streets, and I've heard this so many times, hurt people, right? We know that. Everybody talks about that. But he went a little bit farther, and he said, so it's not just about being hurt. It's like even the smallest slight, you want to hurt someone. Someone steps on your foot. Someone cuts you off. Someone looks at your girlfriend wrong. Can you talk about how that's playing out in the streets of Baltimore City?
It's trauma. It's trauma from where we have come from that puts you in a defensive state. If everything is going right with your life, everybody in your circle has a job, and everybody in your circle is doing well, and everybody has a house, everybody has a car, and everybody has a substantial amount of savings, and everybody's doing good, certain things are not going to bother you. But if you're struggling, you got poverty, you got hopelessness, joblessness, you got all of this around you, the smallest things are going to set you off because you're already traumatized from how you're living. So yes, hurt people, and yes, the smallest slight will set you off, but that's not because who that other person is.
Right.
It's just because you're already traumatized by how you're living.
Right.
And that's why we try to push everybody and anybody that can help in any type of way to give people choices. When we talk to people, I'll talk to somebody on the street and I'll say, what is it you want to do in life? If you were doing this, mm-hmm. what is that you would want to do? And if somebody gives me anything.
When you meet young people, so to just back it up for a second. When you meet young people, and I don't mean the young people, because I know, so when I go into schools, Darnell, students, they have dreams. I met students coming in the City Neighbors High School this morning, and I particularly focused on the young men. As a mother of sons, I'm really interested in what's going on with African-American young men. What grade are you at? 9th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade? What's your plan for next year? College.
Right.
Everybody wants to go to college. Okay. So to jump from that to the brothers that we see in the streets.
Corner boys.
The corner boys.
Right.
When you ask them what their plan is, if you're not doing this, what are you going to do? What do they say?
I'm going to give you a true example of one time when I was out in the street and I was talking to this one young brother, and I said, what do you want to do? If you weren't doing this, what would you do? He's like, I would love to get my GED. I want to get my GED because I know if I get my GED, I'll be able to, go further in my education. And I said, you know what? Pulled up my phone. I pulled up everybody I know in my phone that could possibly get him on the track of getting his GED. And I wrote it down, and I gave it to him. I said, you call these people tomorrow, and they will get you on the track to getting your GED. They will put you in a class tomorrow if you want to. So what I did right there is, he now has a choice.
Right.
He can wake up tomorrow morning and say, I can either go back to trapping, or I can call these people that Mr. D gave me yesterday, and I can start going toward my GED. Once people have a choice, that's when the healing starts to happen. But what goes on in Baltimore is people feel like they don't have a choice because they don't know where the resources are. And the resources are out there. They just got to find out where they are, and these resources have to be have enough capital to keep doing what they do. But once you give somebody a choice, and that brother, that young brother I talked to and I gave him that information, I followed with him the next week, and I said, hey, what happened? He's like, Mr. D, I'm starting my GED class today.
Wow.
And I'm not coming back to these streets. This is not for me. I'm going to get my GED, and once I get my GED, I'm going to try to go to college. Because it was the choice that was given to him. And he woke up the next morning and said, I now have another way to go. I don't have to go back out on the streets. I got a choice to do it now. I got a choice that I can make. And that's what needs to happen with everybody we come in contact with. You start giving people choices on what they want to do, and you give them the resources. There's nothing, then all of a sudden their whole horizon opens up.
Let me throw something out, because many years ago, a couple of years ago, I was over at Frederick Douglass High School. And I remember, this young boy I met, Darnell, had such a profound impact on my life. I think about him a lot. I met a young brother in the hallway. He said he was in the 9th grade. And I asked him, I said, hey, what do you want to be? What do you want to do when you grow up? Like, what's a normal question adults ask children? What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to do? Ninth grade, like, what's your plan? And I remember, because I wrote an op-ed column about this for the Apple, but I remember when he said, look, you know, my brother was killed. My father's in jail. I have cousins who've been killed or in jail. I have uncles who have been killed or in jail. He said, what do I want to be when I grow up? Nothing. I'm from Baltimore. I'm already dead. And I'm like, and I went back. I have been trying to find that young man. Because I'm like, whatever happened to him? What happened? If you're already thinking as of ninth grade, because everybody in your life is either dead or in jail that looks like you from your family, you don't think there's a future for you going forward.
And that's the generational trauma that we're facing here in Baltimore. Because so many people get killed, and you got multiple people getting killed in one family, that people just start to think that I'm not going to live past 21. So why am I thinking about a future? Because right. my uncle died and my uncle got killed and my brother got killed and my father got, he's in jail. And so it's the generational trauma that we're trying to break right now. And you break it with love and you break it with resource and you break it with giving people another way to think about the decision you want to make the next day. And it's a hard thing. It's an uphill battle because Baltimore is, we're at over 300 for the, you know, 300 murders for the sixth year in a row. But you got to keep chugging at it. And every one person I talk to that I can veer another way is another life that I know that, okay, they're going to go this way now instead of going that way.
Right. I like that. This idea that you fight it with love. But you
fight it with love.
Resources. Because see, that's the thing, Darnell, because you just can't love people out of a situation. You got to be able to give them reason. You got to do what you did with that young person. Here's a number. Call tomorrow. Because some brothers, and sisters, you got to take them by the hand. Like, I'm going with you tomorrow.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why I told a young brother, I'm going to follow up with you next time I see you because I want to know what you did. When I first started this work, I said to myself, what can I do? How can I be of help to somebody? And I said, I'm going to be of help. Every time I hear about a resource, I'm going to put it in my phone. And I'm going to put the description of the person and what they do in my phone. Mm-hmm. So even if I forget the name, I can just type in jobs and a bunch of names will come up. Or I can type in housing and a bunch of names will come up. So I can have that ready available right then and there. I don't want to tell somebody, let me come back to you. I want to give it to them right then and there because it's right there. It's that moment right there. That's going to change it's going to change the whole horizon. I don't want to have to wait until tomorrow to talk to you. I got it for you right here. Call them right now.
I like that. Let me ask you this. As we talk about Baltimore ceasefire, you just came out of the last ceasefire. When is the next one planned? And how do you build on each one going forward?
So the next one is in November. This past one was really good because there were a lot of resource fairs at this one. So a lot of resources were given out, and we even did that big resource fair over in Harlem Park. So we just expand off of that. When people have, you know, other fairs or other events, we just try to push people toward these events because if we push people toward the places where we know that they're going to be and they're going to get something they didn't have the day before, it helps them. It just helps them. The thing about it is people think it's really intricate to what Baltimore Ceasefire does. It's not intricate for us. It's actually really simple. We are helping people with love and resources. That is it, because that's what people need.
I like that. Love and resources. Oh, I really appreciate you. Thank you so much, Darnell. As always, from Baltimore Ceasefire, what's the date for the next one?
So the next one is the first weekend of November. I don't have the dates right offhand, but it's the first weekend of November.
And we'll talk to you right around there, of course.
Oh, most definitely.
Keep checking that. Help people with love and I think about that because people are like, I'm praying for you. I'm praying. We send good thoughts and prayers. I'm like, yep, good thoughts, prayers, and resources.
Good thoughts, prayers, and resources.
Come on. You got to give
more.
There
it is.
I like that. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, folks, when we come back, I'm going to play a part of the Baltimore Visionary Series with former Chief Justice Robert Bell. You've got to hear this as he talks about how we can transform the landscape of our nation. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Stay with us. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Before I go to my interview with former Chief Justice Robert Bell, Deontay Mayo said, how can we help? How can we volunteer? Volunteer with Baltimore Ceasefire or with Safe Streets. Irene Williams says, we have so many beautiful young people. We have to save them from hopelessness. We save them, Irene, with love and resources. Melissa said, you know what? Many of these kids are trained to give you a response to those questions. Does it matter if they tell you they want to go to college or their parents won't give them the help they need? So they want to go to college, but someone's got to complete the FAFSA. They may not even know what that is. We got to have an infrastructure of resources to be able to help young people. This is how we change the landscape. I want to share with you my conversation with Chief Robert Bell. It's Baltimore Reporting Report presents Baltimore Visionaries, The Stories We Tell. One of my favorite interviews. Enjoy. So, Judge Bell, as someone who served on as a chief judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals from 1996 to 2013, as the first African-American to hold this position, you have seen how the law has changed. Well, when people tell you that they feel we haven't come that far, we haven't advanced that much, as someone who was on the front line and then helped to shape the law, how would you respond to that?
No, I would always acknowledge that we've come a long way from when I started. But I also would be quick to point out that we've not reached the point where we should be, that we still have a long way to go. So I will recognize the shortcomings in the efforts that we've made, while at the same time celebrating those advances that we have made. The problem that I always have in recent days is that we seem to be replowing some of the ground that we've already plowed before. And that is frustrating. It's something that we need to deal with. And hopefully, with this new administration, we'll have some opportunity to see some of that happen.
Can you talk about the Voting Rights Act? Because there's some people, and this is not breaking down the actual Voting Rights Act, but as someone who has seen the changes with us going to the booth, actually voting and making changes, can you speak about why it's important for us to engage ourselves with the vote, why we must participate in that democratic process?
Well, I tell you, this last election is the best example anybody can give. But for the vote of the people of color, particularly Black folk, we would not have been able to change the administrations. We would not have been able to acquire the majority in the Senate. So it points out that even though you're not the majority of the vote, if you vote and you vote smartly, you can have a tremendous impact on the outcome. That's always been the case, and that's really the reason that for all of the impediments that were put up to Black folk and people of color voting, to avoid that impact. In the old days, if Black folk had to vote in the South and had been allowed to vote as in their numbers, the South would be a totally different place from a political standpoint, because you would see a different power dynamic. And we need to recognize that we need to maintain that dynamic in a way that is beneficial to us, of course, but in so doing, we benefit the entire country. So the Voting Rights Act was an important step. It is something that has been cut back, but it's something that we need to try to replow again to get to the point where we're not impeded from voting. But more importantly, we've got to make sure that those of us who are entitled to vote use that franchise, because it will make a tremendous difference.
When I speak to young people today, Judge Bell, I am surprised at how few of them actually know about the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
They're very familiar with Black Lives Matter. They don't know a lot about it. So can you just talk about how key the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was in the 1960s to just reshaping even our own experience in this country through the courts?
Well, the NAACP as an organization is itself a symbolic group that we ought to look back on and celebrate from time to time, because it was the NAACP as an organization that established its Legal Defense Fund. And the purpose of the Legal Defense Fund was to take to the courts those cases where there was discrimination and injustice, particularly with regard to Black and brown people, and try to seek redress. And over the years, it has done so. It has done it well before the 60s. It started really when Charles Hamilton Houston took over the NAACP Legal Defense Fund as its executive director. He started the process of dismantling segregated education, starting with the professional schools and ending up with elementary education and the Brown Gaines Board decision. And it did not do just that. It was also involved in one person, one vote, voting rights issues. It was involved in death penalty cases where the law was being applied inappropriately and discriminately against Black folk. And it did any number of cases, jury trials and how they were constituted. Those were issues that the NAACP Defense Fund dealt with. And it defended folk who were involved in boycotts, trying to seek rights through demonstrations and the like. So it has been on the front lines for years, going back at least to the 30s. And it continues to do so now. In fact, it is much more important now than it was 10 years ago, let's say, because things have begun to tilt in the wrong way once again. And it is that organization that's going to lead the way, along with others, to ensuring that we see some semblance of justice.
I was just thinking, Judge Bell, just, you know, over the past 4 years, the fights that have happened as we have been working to try to hold on to many of the rights that are being rolled off. As a judge, as someone who knows the law, what do you think we've lost over the last 4 years that we need to fight to regain, to restore, in a sense?
Well, part of it started a little before then, and it has to do with voting rights. We're not as protected in the vote as we used to be. You used to have the requirement that states receive pre-approval before they made changes in voting laws in certain southern states and even northern states. We've lost that. And when the Supreme Court decided that that statute was no longer necessary, we've lost, we've lost not a tangible thing, but we've lost the ability over the last 4 years to rely upon a court, a high court, to make decisions which are based in the law as opposed to based on political philosophy. Because the court, which started out as closely divided, is now 6-3 in favor of a conservative point of view. That cannot be measured because we don't know what kinds of issues are going to come before the court. But let me just say that it is troubling that that court exists in those numbers, because any of those issues that are progressive or that are designed to even the playing field are in danger of being lost simply because of the makeup of the court. So I'm not sure that I can tell you that we've lost any particular thing tangibly, except, as I pointed out, the voting rights case or issue. But we do have the potential of losing a lot by virtue of the makeup of the Supreme Court.
Let me ask you, Judge Bell, you mentioned the Supreme Court, which we know is 6-3 leaning toward a more conservative position. Mm-hmm. I'm also greatly concerned about the number of conservative justices and judges that the previous administration actually they were able to get through, to get passed, to get installed. What do you think the impact is going to be on that? Not the Supreme Court highest level, but even the shift towards more conservative judges on the appellate court level, you know, even lower down. Like, what's going to be the impact of that?
There's potentially negative. Depending upon, and there's precedent for seeing people who are appointed with a certain disposition change during the course of their tenure. So there is a possibility that judges who were put on because they were quote unquote conservative will turn out to be in compliance with, will take their oath seriously and will decide cases based on the law, and therefore that conservative philosophy will not be reflected in the decision. So there's that possibility. But the danger is that we will not have a court dedicated, or we will not have decisions in many instances, many more instances than that was the case before, that are not based on the rule of law, but are based upon some political philosophy, some predetermined notion as to what the law ought to be. And so that's the danger of putting judges on based on some philosophy as opposed to based upon their knowledge of the law and their dedication to the rule of law. And I think in the last 4 years, we've seen people who were deemed unqualified elevated the courts for a lifetime tenure only because they were in the right political party. They spouted the right political the right judicial views. And that is problematic because it could spell some really bad decisions from the standpoint of this country's purported beliefs in the future.
It also kind of got people talking about the possibility of term limits, particularly for Supreme Court justices. As someone who served as a chief judge, what do you think about that? So we won't have a person who was elevated because of their political beliefs and ideology at the right time, who's very young, who could potentially shape this country for the next 40 years.
Well, you know, people can talk about term limits all they want. It won't work.
Okay.
In order to get a term limit, you've got to amend the Constitution. Because the Constitution gives lifetime tenure to the federal judiciary. It's not going to happen. So, I mean, you know, we can talk about the value or the validity of term limits all we want. It's just not going to happen. For me, term limits are not things that I focus much on because, you know, we have term limits for political offices. We have term limits already.
Right.
And it is the people voting people out. So I don't focus very much on term limits because the term, you know, you put a term limit in place and the person serves for that term. You may lose something if we have everybody leaving at the same time.
Right.
There's something called institutional memory that needs to be taken into account. But for me, term limits is not an issue because we have built-in term limits with the vote, and we ought to use it as such.
The reality of that is hard to accept, and I know that you are correct. Changing the Constitution is not something that is going to happen, but the reality is hard to accept when you look at the tenure of some of the justices who've been there quite a long time and those that are now coming on to the court. It is a hard thing to imagine how much.
Well, keep in mind something. Yeah. But keep in mind something. There's a flip side of that. You know, the flip side is that over the years, the Supreme Court has been the North Star that we've looked to for corrective actions.
Right.
And it has delivered more often than not. And you've had judges on, justices on that court who've served for years and years and years. Some of the best justices we've ever had served many years beyond what some of us might think would have been a convenient retirement age. Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes.
Were we to have term limits, would not have been on the court as long as she was. Nor Thurgood Marshall. Justice Stevenson. Nor my favorite, Justice Douglas. Any number of them would have been required to leave. And many of the cases and decisions that we had under their tenure would not have existed, or would have been in danger of not having been decided. So I caution that even if we could do term limits, I'm not sure that would be the answer, because it does indeed limit those good justices from delivering the decisions that needed to be delivered at the time that they delivered them.
So you're at a place now where you probably can use the long eye of history and look back at your own career. What are some of the moments where you look and say, you know, I actually had it right at this moment, like, you know, where I stood, how I voted, how I decided, I got it right at that moment?
Well, no, I have a feel, you know, it's difficult to do that I don't know that I can even do it, really, to tell you the truth. As a judge, when you're sitting as a single judge, as a trial judge, you try your best every day to get it right, because it may not matter to anybody other than the litigants before you, but for those litigants, it's the most important case in the world, and you ought to be putting into it the very best that you have. And I always try to do that. When you go to the appellate court, what you do is by committee. It's not just you. You've got one vote, and you've got either three or seven people, the majority of whom must agree with you. And so you do the best you can then, but you hope the court gets it right. There are instances when I think the court did not get it right. For example, same-sex marriage. I thought the court was wrong on that. I was on the right side. What I consider to be the right side. I dissented in that case. You ply your trade as best you can. You make as persuasive an argument as you can in each instance, and hope that the majority agrees with you. Many times they do. Many times they don't. And so that's about all I can say about that.
Now, your career in Baltimore started early on. I'm just thinking back to probably a story you talk about all the time, facing racial segregation as a teenager in Baltimore, a well-told tale about your life. Switch the question a little bit, because I would urge people, in terms of learning that tale, go down to the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture and go and see the exhibit on Judge Bell. You go see your robe. I mean, I used to have my sons sitting at the feet of your robe, and I would have them learn about your life. Yeah. So that people can learn that there. To turn that question a little bit, because we have racial segregation happening in Baltimore today, in terms of
course. Yeah.
So what would you tell teenagers today? What would you tell them in terms of pushing back against it?
Well, you know, I always say that if one sees something that they feel is unjust, they have some responsibility to do something about it. Maybe not alone, but you know, they ought to be involved. I tell young people that the reason I'm pleased with where I ended up is because I was able, through the assistance of other young people, to get my grounding early on, and to recognize when there's injustice that you have some responsibility to say something about it and do something about it. Many people are afraid to get involved because it's going to have an impact negatively, or could, on them and their career and as they pursue their future. I've always believed and my life has been indicative of that, that if you attack injustice, if you take a stand, if you act appropriately and with morally and with conviction, things generally will work out. And my example is when I started at 16 at the encouragement of the Morgan State University students, it was college in those days. When I started, I didn't think about until later the potential impact on my career. But as it turns out, rather than hurting my career, that activism, that movement with conviction helped it. When I went to law school, I was afraid to write the essay about being arrested. But having written it, I realized that it was something that the law school thought was a positive as opposed to a negative. So one has to recognize that you need to do what's right, whatever you think the consequences might be, because the consequences will not be nearly so bad as you think they're going to be. In other words, if you do the right thing, generally things will turn out all right.
Now, as somebody who lived through the civil rights movement, where you were part of the change that we've had in this country, what do you think that we get wrong about it? And then I ask you that question just so you'll know, is that we're doing a series to really confront some of the myths that are being told about the civil rights movement. The myth of Rosa Parks being an elderly woman who was tired, right? And replacing that with the truth about right? So what do you think we get wrong?
I don't think we did anything wrong in the civil rights movement. I think that one can go back and look at the goals that we set, and one may question the goals in light of consequences that were experienced later on. But I don't think there was anything that we did wrong in terms of addressing those issues and seeking to do something different to change the course of history as it was evolving at that point. And we made certain decisions. Those were the decisions that were made at the time in light of the circumstances that existed at the time. Now, to go back and second guess it, I can say, well, I wish we hadn't dismantled the black school system. Mm. But that's, you know, that's done the secondhand guessing on it. I don't question at all Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall's decision to integrate the school systems. Now, what we probably should have thought more about was what would we do about that infrastructure that was in place for the black schools at the time that we did it. But that's something that we as a society could have dealt with after that decision to proceed to integration was made. So, no, I don't think there's anything wrong with what we did. And I will not. Second guess it. I will second guess the Supreme Court in its decision in Brown, because that court could have ordered immediate desegregation. And had it done so, we probably would not have had as much trouble with the implementation as we had. In other words, that all with all deliberate speed language gave rise to a lot of unnecessary litigation in the future. I will say that that was a mistake, but the decision to go forward and the goal with which we went forward, I don't think that was a mistake at all.
Now, my last question to you, Judge Bell, I want to go back because I just remember when I first met you, when I was a school teacher at West Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And I took a chance to invite you to come to Law Day to meet the students.
Right, yeah.
They were just... Right. So excited. They were allowed to dress up that day. We had food catered. Mm-hmm. And meeting,
I remember, yeah.
For my students, it was just such an amazing experience. And I just remember that one of my students said, wow, out of all the schools, no one ever says good stuff about us, but he came to our school. Why do you think it's important for mm-hmm. us to pour into young people, particularly young people in Baltimore City who feel overlooked, who feel ignored, who feel that the city doesn't love them, that no one's paying attention to them? Why do you think it's important to do that? And what would you suggest we do more of to help them?
The real point is that we tend to model our behavior based on the role models that we set for ourselves or are presented to us. And if you don't have examples that you look up to and that you can relate to or look like you, you're not likely to be as what you're going to, you necessarily will do okay. A lot of people will do okay, but not as many people will see it as a natural progression. And so I think it's important that we present ourselves to students in order to give them that, I guess, encouragement. And well, it really is to reflect for them what's possible. And having done that, they can determine to seek to emulate or even to go beyond that which has been presented to them as an example. So it's the same thing. I think African Americans and other people of color need to be available to serve as role models, just as I believe that judges ought to be available to inform the citizenry of what's going on in the legal system. It's the example that it's set that's so important.
Thank you so much. The Honorable Robert Bell served as Chief Judge on the Maryland Court of Appeals, which is in the court in state from 1996 to 2013. He was the first African-American to hold the position at 16 years of age. Robert Bell was a lead plaintiff in Bell v. Maryland, a case that ultimately helped push the United States towards desegregation. Judge Bell, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for all those years ago that you committed to coming to our school and to not only coming yourself, but you brought Black lawyers and judges and law students with you to fill our building with love and hope and inspiration. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon. On Light Rail Link, we have the work continuing between Falls Road and Camden Yard stations. There is shuttle bus service available. Expect delays. Allow extra time for your travel on Light Rail Link. Metro Subway Link has no delays. On MARC, big news today. We have all the regular schedule now is back on all the MARC lines today. We do have some delays to go along with that. On the Penn Line train, 439, 5 to 10 minute delay. Also on the Penn Line, train 537, a 5 to 10 minute delay. On the Camden Line, we've got train 848 at a 10 to 15 minute delay. One more on the Penn Line, train 641, a 5 to 10 minute delay. For the MTA Transit Team, I'm Amy Friedman on 88.9 FM WEAA, the voice of the community.